to episode 28 of the Anthrozoology Podcast. I'm Michelle Sidlowski. My PhD is in anthrozoology and my focus is on elephant-human relations.
I'm Chris, and my research focuses on cat-human relations and discourses surrounding urban roaming cats.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm looking at shark-human relationships, and I'm also interested in feline lives in Saudi Arabia based on my master's dissertation.
So welcome to a special mini episode of the Anthrozoology Podcast. Today we're discussing interventions developed for the treatment of juvenile and adult animal abusers. Our guest is Dr. Ken Shapiro, the founder of Animals and Society Institute and a clinical psychologist focused on the assessment and treatment of juveniles and adults who abuse animals. Let me offer a quick trigger warning. This episode discusses animal neglect and abuse and may be troubling to some listeners. Welcome, Ken.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, can you talk a little bit about the concept of the link and how that applies to our conversation today?
Sure. So, arguably, the link is fits within the scope of human-animal studies. And the link refers to the relationship between human violence and animal abuse. And there's been considerable literature, starting with some FBI studies, which showed that mass killers also had a childhood history of animal abuse. So that got the thing going, but it's since broadened significantly in that we are able to show that various forms of antisocial behavior are correlated with animal abuse. The initial idea was that it was the graduation hypothesis, that one graduated from herding the cat or dog as a kid to herding humans. There is very little empirical support for that. So the alternative hypothesis is the deviance generalization hypothesis, which just says that they're associated, that one can come before the other can come before the one, you know, who knows? But if there is one, there's likely to be the other. That is, antisocial behavior and animal abuse are correlated or associated. So given that, what do we do about it? What ASI did was first develop presentations in which we demonstrated the link through the literature. And then moving on from that, we decided to develop an intervention to work with people who were animal abusers. And we developed the Anacare approach. And there was one approach for working with juveniles, one approach for working adults. They've both been published in Springer, revised issues of those. So then I'll go back to this in a minute and talk about a diversion program that we're developing. But first, let me just, there's various policy implications of the link. One is that we need to take seriously animal abuse, and all 50 states have now felonized animal abuse. They've also gotten more sophisticated about differentiating between different kinds of animal abuse, from neglect on the one hand to some horrific kind of torture of animals on the other. They've also, we've seen that there are many paths to animal abuse in the same way that one becomes depressed with various kinds of etiological beginnings of it. There's no one profile of an animal abuser. So this means we need all different kinds of interventions. So we've distinguished between primary, secondary, and tertiary interventions, where primary is simply educating the public. Secondary is identifying at-risk populations. So this might be populations who have done some minor animal abuse, but not yet antisocial behavior to humans, or vice versa, and just giving them some psychoeducational intervention so that they won't become more serious offenders. And the The tertiary prevention is Anacare. That's someone who already is, if you will, a career animal abuser. And again, those come in various degrees of challenge psychotherapeutically. So there's the neglector on the one hand, and there's the torturer on the other hand. So the interesting thing about the neglect is that from an animal's point of view, it doesn't make any difference whether they're hurt by neglect or by torture. The neglect can be horrible, you know, starve to death slowly. But from a psychological point of view, it's more difficult to deal with the torturer than the neglect person. The neglect person may not have any motivations against the animals at all. He just, you know, doesn't have the resources to deal with them. And, you know, to some extent, there's a subclass of the orders who fit into that. That, you know, there were people who wanted to take care of cats and dogs, and they, you know, people started bringing their cats and dogs to them, and they got too many and they couldn't feed them and so forth. So I mean, those people are easier to help than the person who staying with the hoarders. It's really got some serious pathology going there, some boundary problems with respect to their treatment of animals, some denial, sometimes psychotic denial of what's happening to the animals. Very, very difficult to intervene. So Anacare picks a certain part of that population that it can work with. The people who are real psychopaths, hard to help. The people who are just neglectors, they don't need Anacare. They just need a diversion program like BARC, which I'll talk about tomorrow. So the middle piece, the Anacare audience, target audience, is people who have abused animals sometimes in the context of family dynamics, where and we emphasize that in order to understand a family, you need to understand the role of the animals in the family. So the dynamics can involve using the animal as an intimidation of other members of the family, human members of the family. So that requires a certain kind of intervention. Another possible presentation of animal abuse is that they really hate animals or a particular species of animals. There's cat haters. I'm sorry. And you know the dynamics of that go back to some association between cats and women, for example. There's also some people who abuse dogs, and the dog fighting population fits into there. They are people who over-identify with their animal, and when their animal lets them down, that's a narcissistic blow to them, and they punish the animal. So those are some of the areas that we work in. The other area that's important with Anacare is the recognition that some of the animal abuse's origins lies in cultural or subcultural views of animals. So, some subculture, you eat animal, you eat the dogs. Some subcultures, you train them to fight. In some cultures, you sleep with them, literally and affectionately, both. So we have to do some values clarification, if you will. We have to almost be an anthropologist in the therapy sometimes. So, that's the way you were brought up to view that way. And how do we move past that? Well, we can educate them about the actual needs of animals. We can show them inconsistencies in their value presentation, even their own value presentation. So, for example, some hunters may be killing animals in ways that are unacceptable to other hunters. And so we could point out that. So anyway, that's an introduction to Anacare.
I have a question about that. It's just in that something that you said keyed in my head. Is it commonly an animal known to the abuser? Or is it are there abusers that go out just find whatever animal they can?
Mostly the former. Mostly it's within the family dynamics. It's the use of the animal to control the family. It's the animal as a scapegoat when there's family problems. It's mostly family dynamics, but it's also, my neighbor's dog is barking all night. I know how to put an end to that. It's rarely just going out and randomly hurting an animal, but certainly adolescents do that. It's a boring afternoon. What are we going to do today? Well, why don't we go get that cat? And so they go and they put the cat in the bag and they throw the cat around and they set fire to the cat, et cetera, et cetera. So, but it's mostly within a family context. Even when the object of the target of the abuse is outside of the family, it often stems from family dynamics. So we really need to train people in sort of systems analysis of the family and the history of the role of the ways in which animals have been treated in that family and so forth.
No, I sort of going back to this using the animal to intimidate. I guess you mean sort of as a form of punishment. So I know there's been a lot of research done on women, families don't want to, are reluctant to leave an abusive situation because shelters don't take on companion animals. And I've seen there's sort of been some encouraging progress there with facilities now allowing. Exactly. Because that's sort of a big reason to stay in a very dangerous situation is because they have very good reason to sort of fear their cat or dog. And and I think that's a powerful area of that research that has actually slowly, maybe not fast enough, been translated into policy.
Yes. Yeah. So the safe haven policy is an important development. And we credit Frank Accione for that mostly, who he did the original studies showing how often an animal was implicated in domestic violence toward the spouse. But it's not just punishment of the animal, it's using the animal as a threat. It's threat of punishment, it's the threat of abuse. Okay, so if you don't do such and such, I'm going to do such and such to your dog. But yeah, the safe havens is an important, there's a lot of policy implications. Another one is we're beginning to, there's a thing called Desmond's Law. Are you familiar with that?
So
that comes out of University of Connecticut Law School. Jessica Rubin mostly started this, but several states now allow court to select a representative of the animal in a case that involves animals. So there's someone sitting there who's sort of an advocate or more like an educational resource to the prosecutor and the judge, but in effect it's an animal representative. There's actually some animal welfare courts now. But one thing I should make clear about the Anacare project is that part of the context of it is that prosecutors were not prosecuting animal abuse. They just didn't give it enough value, importance. They were overcrowded. So the link shows them that it will contribute, prosecuting will contribute to the reduction of human abuse. So that's the power politically of the link. It's related to the incarceration problem that we have in this society. So not only are the courts overcrowded, the prisons are overcrowded. Not only that, most of the data shows that imprisoning people doesn't really help them that much, that they learn crime there, that mm-hmm. the recidivism is huge. So that while many animal rights people want to say, well, don't treat them, throw them in jail. We don't buy that at all. We're trying to get the prosecutors to take the cases by offering them diversion programs that would be in some instances instead of, in lieu of prison time. So that's BARC. It's a diversion program that is I'd call it psychoeducational. It's not just educational. It's not just like intense psychotherapy. It's sort of in between. And I can describe that more in detail. But currently, our current project is to create a self-directed BARC intervention program. So that would mean that we wouldn't need to, as we have in the past, train therapists all over the country to do this kind of work, because it would be virtual. And so the therapist, you know, could just be, and the therapist the therapist might do an initial assessment and maybe a final assessment at the end, but the person basically would do a self-directed intervention and go through and, you know, work at his or her own pace and so forth. And then we would report back to the court and say they completed the intervention, and we wouldn't give details about what happened in it because that's confidential. But and then the judge would accordingly make the sentence reflect that successful completion of the intervention. So there's an anti-carceral feature of this that we're plugging into. And we're dealing with getting the courts to recognize the importance of animal abuse and broader, the public to understand that animal abuse is a problem and that animals don't deserve to be abused. And, you know, so it's a general educational project. It's not just helping that individual who's an animal abuser. It has a much broader implication as we see it.
What's been the success? Do you have statistics? Because it's been around for a while now, right? Since the late 90s. What is the success rate for people who've gone through the program and people who haven't?
I sure wish I had an answer to that question, but I don't. Okay. And there's a number of reasons why I don't. The nature of an evaluation study of a program is such that you need a significant number of clients. They need to have gone through the exact same protocol. And we just haven't been able to have that. We just have, you know, we have cases here and there. And so that's another purpose of the self-directed program. It's going to be, it's going to increase the N, if you will. So more and more people will take it. The intervention itself will include a pre and post validation instrument, which will look at things like attitudes towards animals, degree of empathy, aggressive inclinations, etc. And it'll be given before and after and then down the road. And so that will allow us to become an evidence-based approach. We are not yet an evidence-based approach. I mean, there's indirect support because a lot of the interventions were borrowed from domestic violence interventions, you know, changing woman to animal or something like that, you know, those were effective. Those have been validated. So we're only indirectly validated. And that's a very serious issue in this day of evidence-based treatment approaches.
Do you find that this push toward humane education, especially for young children, is going to have an effect or is having an effect, sort of building in that empathy early on and strengthening the relationship? Is that something that you see as beneficial?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, the history of the field of humane education, of course, Zoe Weil being a major contributor to that. So, I mean, I think, you know, years ago, it was what was it called? Dog and pony something. You know, you just.
Dog and pony show.
What?
A dog and pony show.
Yes, thank you. So, you know, you'd go in there and you'd have one class, you know, by a humane educated person would come in and they talk about, you know, well, you need to feed the dog and the water and the shelter and the bring in from the rain and the leash and so forth, you know. But since then, the field has broadened significantly. Zoe Weil includes environmental issues now. We also would include teaching people to be more empathetic, particularly to animals. I mean, some people are empathetic, but only to humans. Some people are not empathetic at all. Some people are only empathetic to animals, but those are far and few. So we also want to teach them just problem solving skills. So that, you know, that gets to anger management and stress management and, you know, how to deal with issues. So it becomes a humane education becomes a broader intervention. It's not just one class, you know, you go in, it's a course that you would take. And so we're training people, not ASI, but in support of it, training people to be humane educators and to develop courses and to include the environment issue, the Anthropocene issue, the socialization of children, the role of animals in socializing children, which has positives and negatives. The child sees that the animal needs to be taken care of, and you have to be responsible in taking care of the animal. On the other hand, the child sees that animals die early, and you know, that can be positive or negative depending on how you deal with the grief at the loss. So but animals need to be recognized as an important socializing agent in the development of children, and humane education is a major contributor to that education.
What do you think is the key to I'll ask fast and then you go. What do you think is the key to building empathy in children for animals, like just, you know, general rule of thumb?
There's a couple of nice very books on this, but you know, we in Anacare and in BARC believe that empathy is a skill that can be learned. It's also true that it has some constitutional beginnings. So you know, you've heard about this mirror neuron. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we all have some automatic visceral response when, you know, I stub my toe, you wince also. We have that, and we can build on that to train empathy. But you know, it's fairly straightforward to teach empathy. We give, for example, one can indicate various scenarios, so here's a dog that just was taken for a walk. Here's a dog that is being chained in the backyard. I want you to role play being the dog who's just been taken on a walk. Okay, how was that? I want you to role play the dog who's stuck on the chain all day and no one's out there. And what's that like for the dog? And, you know, so role playing, building on the ability that we have to do that. Also education, of course, about the needs of the animals. How they contribute to our well-being in various ways. Empathy is a very, very important tool, and one can educate one in it.
If I could ask a question about BARC, you said that it's going to be an online program.
Yes.
So is that currently only prescribed by the court? Have you thought about, or would it be possible for people to self-interventionize, that's probably not the right word, but to
intervene?
To think to themselves, look, I think I'm actually I'm having some anger issues, or I'm having some difficulties, and I'm thinking thoughts I shouldn't be having about a particular animal that I know. I think I need to quietly go online and ask these questions about myself and reflect on what I'm doing and what I can find myself some tools or be given some tools.
Okay, so we anticipate that the primary source of referrals will be from the courts.
Right.
For BARC. However, there are other possible sources. One is veterinarians, and veterinarians are being trained more and more in the identification of animal abuse. There's also this field called veterinary social work at University of Tennessee, where they're helping veterinarians to be more psychologically sophisticated about, you know, the needs of animals and the needs of the humans and their own needs. You know, veterinarians commit suicide at a higher level than most. Excuse me, one sec. So veterinarians is another source. Another source is the schools. So you have guidance counselors, and, you know, kids come, and we want guidance counselors to always ask about whether there's any animal abuse going on when a kid presents to them. You know, they're having difficulties at home and something, you know. So that's another source. But in terms of your suggestion that people might self-refer, many of the people who end up in Anacare or BARC have a very serious problem with accountability. It's only a dog. If you can kill deer, I can certainly kick my dog.
Right.
I didn't do anything wrong. The animal wasn't really hurt. My friend made me do it. You know, so that establishing the working therapeutic relationship has to deal with that problem of resistance, which is the failure to say, I'm responsible for what happened in some way. So the self-referral is there's not going to be a hell of a lot of people who do that.
Yeah. Sorry, I do have a second question as well. You were talking before about the physical abuse of animals, and then those cases are reported. Obviously, physical issues of through neglect or torture are very easy to see. What about psychological welfare, and how are those cases picked up? For example, a companion animal or an animal might be very well fed and healthy, but might be emotionally abused all day in some way. How is that caught in the net?
Oh, that's a great question. Harder to identify for sure. There are certainly animal behaviorists now who treat dogs and cats who have, for example, separation anxiety, or who have what's called food, they guide their food too aggressively or something.
Yeah.
So that would be a way of identifying to some extent, but it's going to be harder to, you know, just an unhappy dog. You know, the dog sleeps all day. That's what the dog wants to do. Much, much more difficult to identify that, but it's certainly important.
Thank you.
I mean, in general, that's a primary education intervention where we just need to teach people what constitutes a good life for a dog and a cat. You know, that you can't just say hello to them in the morning and hello to them when you walk in the evening and feed them and then maybe take them for a 20-minute walk. They have to be members of that family who are treated as such, who have their own needs, who some of the scheduling of the family events has to be built around the needs of the dog and the cat. You can't go out too long and leave the cat and the dog alone, particularly if they have anxiety around separation. You know, so it's an education that when you take on having a cat or a dog, it's almost like having another child.
And a final question related to this, if you don't mind, is this USA only, or if you had an organization which was outside of the USA that said they were interested in your work and implementing some things, even just on a website, or you know, to get people to think, is that something that your organization would consider?
Yes, absolutely, sure. So you know, we've done 50 or 60 webinars. No, not webinars. Sorry, actual in-person symposia, workshops is the word, in 22 different states in the United States. We would be happy to do a workshop in, you know, UK or Saudi Arabia or whatever.
Perfect.
That's a money issue. That's a labor issue. Okay. And that, again, that's one of the reasons why we want the self-directed thing. If the self-directed thing was online, then it makes it much easier to teach people because they can just go to that. We also have recordings of some of the workshops. So We certainly would be open to its spreading around, but right now it's, you know, we're trying to get it going in the United States mostly.
I did have one quick question, or actually two. One, when you were talking about emotional abuse, and I guess that's where, education, working, or sort of paying attention to children is so important, because there is that fine line between teasing, and I think we're all sort of been guilty of teasing our cat or our dog a little bit, and it's funny and cute, but it's not really, especially if it's sort of ongoing. And children, I think especially, they think that it's playing, but it's teasing that becomes frustrating, and then suddenly they lash out, and then it's the cat's fault. I think that's where education is key, because it doesn't necessarily start off as malicious, right? They think it's funny, and they don't. Yeah, and then it developing.
That's part of the assessment of a juvenile would be the history of the teasing. At some points it's age appropriate in this culture, to put the magnifying glass on the ants, to pull the wings of the butterfly, and we certainly would intervene there and ask and teach the parents about teaching the kids. But if that persists, at the age of 7, 8, 9, 10, and becomes a little bit more harmful to the animals or different species of animals, then, so, we're making an assessment to see the nature of the intervention that's needed. If a person has a pattern of behavior, beginning with the teasing and then moves on to, more serious abuse, then accordingly we would describe what interventions needed.
Thank you. Yeah. And I guess on the other side, and I was looking, I couldn't actually find the reference. I was talking about it a few weeks ago with children of hunters. And there was some research done that a lot of the time the children had to be indoctrined, is not the right word, but that sort of experience and sort of seeing the kill, it was often very traumatizing, and they had to sort of learn. So it's almost like the opposite. They had inherent empathy, and then they were sort of went out and exposed to that hunting culture and essentially had to toughen up, and then they became sort of deer hunters, and I guess that sort of leads into the I kick a dog, it's only a dog, I shoot deer. And it made me sort of think that inherently children are empathetic, but I guess there's sort of a spectrum, and you can learn it.
They are inherently empathic, and they over-empathize, if you will. So, the toast popped out of the toaster and fell onto the floor. Oh, did the toast get hurt? The leaf fell down, the leaf. So we have to teach them the appropriate class of objects that are reasonably objects of our empathy. And oftentimes we're educated to exclude animals. You just empathize with people. So that's where we need to intervene. But the opposite of empathy is desensitization.
So do you think children should go hunting?
I don't think anybody should go hunting. I mean, look at the reduction of wildlife. I mean, we just, why don't they just go watch a football game and watch people smash into each other?
Good answer.
I suppose, I think, why would anyone who isn't starving go hunting, right? I mean, I guess I could sort of understand people who have no other access to food, but yes, I don't understand why people US.
Sure. Or, I'm talking about sport hunting.
Sport hunting, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
So I just have one last question for you then. Does this type of thing present differently the first time in youth and adults? Like, is there a different sort of first sign that you see with an adult abuser who just started as an adult versus a child, or is there something different that psychologists look at?
So what was your question? If a person presents and only became an abuser as an adult, as opposed
yes.
to, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very important prognostically. So if it's an acquired behavior, in their 20s, as opposed to a pattern of behavior that began when they were 5 years old, obviously it's much more difficult to intervene. and the kind of intervention has to be much more intensive. So yes, the part of the assessment is to take a history of human-animal relationships. And if it's, if the person, particularly if the person had a history of a good relationship with a cat or a dog when they were young, and then somehow later in their 20s, they started abusing animals, that becomes a very nice way of helping them, because we can build on that relationship that you had at one time.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Ken. We had a wonderful conversation, and don't forget to join us again on the next episode of the Anthrozoology Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today on episode 28 of the Anthrozoology Podcast. You can find links to Ken's work in the description, which accompanies this podcast. And if you have any questions, please reach out to us on our website, which is also listed in the same place. Thank you.